Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun, Dan Rogics here with Roughly Speaking, episode 312 for Friday, the 20th of October, 2017. Today on the show, what's become of Black Lives Matter? Danny McLean, a contributing writer to The Nation, gives us an update on the movement. It has not, despite reports to the contrary, gone underground or gone silent. Culture commentator Sherry Parks will be with us again today, this time to discuss the Harvey Weinstein scandal and just what we mean by open secrets and whether even powerful men get to live with them in the internet age. Before we get to those conversations, Paula Gallagher has a book to recommend. This one is a historical novel called Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan, winner of the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for fiction.
Our story begins in New York City in 1934 with an 11-year-old girl by the name of Anna Carrigan, who lives with her parents and her severely disabled sister. Her father, the family doesn't quite understand what he does, but the reader gets to see that he is a bagman for a crooked union boss. So we're getting so many things in this novel. We're getting the immigrant experience. We're getting to hear about classism, racism, you know, the seamy underside of what was going on in the city at the time. And so we're now in Brooklyn at the Naval Yards. We're in the throes of World War II. Jennifer Egan does a fantastic job in sucking you into that time period. I feel like at times in reading the novel, as if I were in one of those Turner classic films. She seems to have the language right, the dialogue, the rich detail of the clothing and the food and the interactions between people. But this is a coming-of-age story, and Anna is very much a heroine to be admired. She's strong, she's resilient, and she wants more out of life than what she's been dealt. And she's hoping to better herself. You know, just a very interesting story. It's a novel to get lost in. And we've got spot-on dialogue, again, terrific period details. It's a story with a feminist spark. It's a story of familial love and longing. Again, this novel is Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan.
Baltimore County librarian Paula Gallagher reviews books and recommends one a week on the Roughly Speaking podcast. Now, Black Lives Matter. Despite reports to the contrary, BLM is alive and well, though you hear less about it these days. It doesn't make news as often as it did just a couple of years ago. And now, writes Danny McLean in The Nation, when Black Lives Matter gets a mention, it's because a member of the Trump administration is issuing a dog whistle to the president's supporters, as was the case recently when Trump's personal attorney forwarded an email to conservative journalists characterizing BLM as, quote, totally infiltrated by terrorist groups, end quote. But even in more sympathetic portrayals, BLM is said to have lost or squandered the power it began building in July 2013 after George Zimmerman's acquittal in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. According to a recent BuzzFeed article, BLM is beset by debilitating internal rifts over direction and funding, preventing the movement from doing much at all to accomplish its aims. Danny McLean spent some time looking deeper, and her October 9th cover story for The Nation takes a comprehensive look at what BLM chapters around the country are up to these days and what they're planning for the years ahead. A judge down in Louisiana a couple weeks ago, actually late September, found that Black Lives Matter is a social movement and can't be sued. This was in a lawsuit brought by a police officer who claimed that he had been hurt in a protest involving BLM. And DeRay McKesson was listed in that case, too. DeRay, who used to be here in Baltimore. And I was wondering, how much, among the people you spoke with for your article, how much did they worry about this lawsuit, lawsuits like it?
They were very worried. And the primary way that conversation around this lawsuit came up was in a conversation that I had with Patrice Kahn-Cullors, who is one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter hashtag, and she's in a leadership position with the Black Lives Matter Global Network. And it came up because she was very clear about the training and the kind of onboarding process that she and, you know, BLM, Global Network, demand of local chapters that want to become actual BLM chapters as opposed to, you know, just whatever, you know, some local racial justice group. And so, you know, needing to have these conversations with local organizers to tell them, you know, this is appropriate behavior, this is what we suggest for your organizing, this is what you're going to have to agree to do in order to be able to use the BLM name and march under a BLM banner and that type of thing. And when I pressed her, because I had heard from some local organizers who were kind of frustrated by the what they felt to be hoops that they had to jump through in order to become, you know, official BLM chapters, and she was very clear. She said, look, we have these kind of rogue groups that call themselves BLM and then use really inflammatory language targeting, you know, specific police officers, or they're just not very disciplined. And in an environment in which we're, you know, being sued, or, you know, where there are these questions about whether or not we're creating a kind of environment in which individual police officers are being harmed, we can't risk that. And so they were, the organizers who I spoke to at the national level were very concerned about these lawsuits. And especially because, and I talk about this in the article, really last summer, July of 2016, was when the officers were killed in Dallas and then in Baton Rouge. There was a real turning point in the movement, because after that point, we really saw a lot of conservative commentators, you know, calling BLM a hate group, a terrorist organization, and specifically laying blame for the deaths of those police officers at the feet of BLM. And so I really think that, you know, the news that you mentioned is probably a huge weight off the shoulders of these organizers.
It was interesting, after Dallas, you point out in the article that BLM groups didn't go quiet after that happened, even though they were being blamed by conservative commentators for the violence in Dallas. They actually doubled down on action in the following weeks.
That's right. There was a coalition of groups in Chicago, in New York, in Oakland, who decided, you know, people are kind of calling for us to take responsibility for these shootings, or else to just kind of go quiet and go silent and kind of hide, you know, go be quiet until all this blows over. I spoke to an organizer in Chicago named Charlene Carruthers, who's a leader with the BYP 100, the Black Youth Project 100, who talked to me about her group and others deciding that they were actually going to launch a series of direct actions. So what they did was they did lockdowns in places like the police union headquarters in Lower Manhattan, at Holman Square in Chicago, which is where the Chicago Police Department had been holding suspects without proper legal representation. And there was another, I think the Oakland Police Department was the other site. And she said, you know, we decided to show up at these places where we could draw attention to systemic police abuse issues, systemic issues of police accountability, to drive home the message that, you know, our movement does not center itself around individual police officers. We have been clear that we're talking about institutional, you know, problems with the institution and problems with the criminal justice system as a whole. And so they really felt that this was a way to kind of double down on their vision, which is not about harming individual police officers, they said, but was instead about demanding accountability of the system as a whole.
Someone who's not paying attention the way you are might say that Black Lives Matter was driven underground from the backlash after Dallas, after last year, Trump's election. We just didn't hear that much about the Black Lives Matter and wondered whether it was going to continue.
It's fair. I mean, I've been reporting on BLM organizing and this current iteration of Black racial justice organizing since, I don't know, 2012 or 2013. And I noticed that they had gotten quiet as well. What I learned, though, when I started asking around was that was not the case. You know, I in the course of reporting this story, the Charlottesville, you know, the white supremacists showed up in Charlottesville, and there was the counter protesters showed up as well, and Heather Heyer was killed, and, you know, this became a real flashpoint. And so I I called around in Charlottesville to say, because I wasn't really hearing about BLM being a part of the kind of ecosystem of groups, of, you know, groups among the counter-protesters in Charlottesville. But sure enough, they were very present there, and had been organizing, not just in the run-up to, you know, the kind of events that made national news, but, you know, the whole conversations around Confederate monuments in Charlottesville and the other times over the course of the spring and summer that white supremacists and alt-right groups had been showing up in the city. And similarly, BLM Boston played a big role in, you know, showing up this summer when white supremacists were planning to be on the move there. And right. So what I saw was that, yes, I mean, BLM, we don't hear about them so much being in the street and protesting as we had in, you know, beginning in the summer of 2013 with the acquittal of Zimmerman. That's when really the movement kind of got a huge boost, and many people talk about that as being the launch. We heard about them in street protests quite a bit, the period of 2013, 2014, 2015, but less so more recently. And what I also learned was that they're in some ways shifting tactics, and that there's a new focus on moving into the electoral political realm as well.
What are you seeing there? Are they actually getting behind candidates? Are they working on voter turnout versus voter suppression?
I talked to an organizer in BLM Lansing, so this is Michigan, who they are doing, they're really focused on voter education and really trying to better understand the system and educate themselves and their neighbors about the electoral process. And so, you know, the organizer who I spoke to there, one of the things that she pointed out was, you know, we were just kind of shocked by Trump getting elected. And, you know, if he did not win, one of the things that she said to me was, if Trump didn't win the popular vote, then why is he president? In other words, it's time to start looking seriously at the Electoral College and these other kind of pieces of the electoral system that they felt consistently disenfranchised and marginalized black voters. And so they, you know, intend to, they're holding candidates forums around local elections, and they intend to build this statewide coalition so that they can get involved in the state and eventually the national level as well. I think some of the most interesting reporting I did on the electoral piece came through conversations with a young organizer in St. Louis named Kayla Reed, who's a leader with St. Louis Action Council, which is a group that grew up in the wake of the Ferguson protests. Kayla Reed and her associates, they got curious about the race for the circuit attorney, St. Louis circuit attorney, which is the city's top prosecutor job, and they decided that they were going to learn about it. You know, what does this office actually do? And let's start to interview the candidates to see where they stand on issues such as cash bail, marijuana decriminalization, the school-to-prison pipeline. And so they started, interviewing candidates, holding candidates forums, and they now credit themselves with helping to elect the city's first black circuit attorney, Kim Gardner. They were so kind of excited by that victory that they got really involved in the last mayoral election, and they did, you know, something similar. They got involved with candidate forums. They actually used the Vision for Black Lives, which is the platform, the policy platform that the Movement for Black Lives put out last year, August of 2016, that kind of lays out the movement's vision and gets very kind of granular around policy demands. And Taylor told me that they used this document as a kind of framework for coming up with questions to ask candidates who are running for mayor. And they got really interested in a candidate named Tashara Jones, the city's treasurer, and they threw their weight behind Tashara. She ended up losing by just 888 votes, but she was really underestimated by the city's top politicians and media. She was polling at something like, I don't know, I think it was 8%, I can't remember now, but certainly single digits. And she ended up coming in, you know, losing by this very slim margin. And Kayla said, you know, we knew that there was a huge amount of support for Tashara among black communities in St. Louis. These are communities that, you know, sometimes won't go to the polls if they don't feel really inspired by a candidate. But Kayla knew that there was a lot of support for Tashara and was not at all surprised when she ended up, coming in such a close second.
Let me ask you this, Danny. If you were to describe Black Lives Matter today in one or two sentences, I mean, or could you draw an organizational chart? It doesn't seem to be that kind of thing. It seems to be more of a sort of a loose confederation of chapters with some control over what gets to be a chapter and who gets to run it and how people are trained. Is that accurate?
I think that's fair. One of the words that's often used to characterize the movement is leaderful. In other words,
lots of leaders, lots of local leaders.
That's right. Lots of leaders, decentralized leadership, but lots of collaboration, among groups. So, as I said earlier, a lot of times people use that phrase BLM to talk about the whole kind of landscape of Black organizing right now. But really, the BLM Global Network is a particular organization that was founded by three Black women after George Zimmerman was acquitted in the summer of 2013. And then you have groups like I mentioned, Black Youth Project 100, that is a national organization, but some of their most visible work is in Chicago. You have groups like the Dream Defenders in Florida, a multiracial group. You have, St. Louis Action Council, this very local group. So what I would say is that it's often one of the kind of umbrella organizations to look to as kind of this collaborative body is called the Movement for Black Lives, which is, provides a space for leaders from this different groups to come together and strategize and talk about, where to go, kind of reflect on where they've been and decide where to go. And so actually the Movement for Black Lives is launching something called the Electoral Justice Project. The Electoral Justice Project, they're launching that in they just launched it. I saw an email from them this week. That's going to do a lot of this voter organizing work that I spoke about on the national level. It's not easy. We're certainly not in the civil rights movement era of you look at a Dr. King and that's where the movement is. Or you can point to this one typically male charismatic leader and say, like, that's who's leading this. No, this is really about, coordinated national and some would say international movement that has a lot of young leaders that are doing kind of any number of things. There's no just one person setting the strategy and tactics.
Well, Dani, thank you for your time and congratulations on a well-reported piece.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dani McLean is a contributing writer to The Nation. You can find a link to her story on Black Lives Matter in the notes with this podcast. Sherry Parks joins us next, and we'll be talking about the Harvey Weinstein scandal right after this message from our sponsor.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Walter Isaacson, author of the acclaimed bestsellers Steve Jobs, Einstein, and Benjamin Franklin. Now Isaacson brings to life history's most creative genius, Leonardo da Vinci, in an exciting new biography based on Da Vinci's astonishing notebooks and new discoveries about his life and work. Hosted by the Church of the Redeemer at 5603 North Charles Street on Saturday, October 21st. Doors open at 7 p.m. with the program beginning at 7:30. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Someday, we'll look back on the great Harvey Weinstein scandal of 2017 as the moment the worm turned on the patriarchy, at least for a while. It was the critical mass that did it. Among the many remarkable things about the story has been the way it has unfolded or unfurled, like a gradual awakening, a slow yet shockingly sudden coming to from a long, ambient waking nightmare. That's how writer Karina Chicano opens her piece in Rolling Stone under the headline, Why the Harvey Weinstein Scandal Could Change Our Culture. That's an optimistic headline, but the question is interesting. Accusations of sexual assault come and go, but because of Weinstein's position, could this be the beginning of real change? Maybe. But of course, we've been here before. In fact, in the time of Donald Trump, who bragged about groping women and was elected president, men of significant stature have been brought down by allegations of sexual misconduct, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Bill Cosby. While noting that, American culture commentator Sherry Parks isn't so optimistic that men conditioned to objectifying, mistreating, and assaulting women can change their ways.
I'm glad that these stories are coming out because sexual harassment happens a lot.
Why now? Why do you think this has been happening? Fox News, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Harvey Weinstein.
Well, I think there was a snowball effect for sure. I mean, both of us recognize that. But I think what is happening is that the men, not the women, at first, were newsworthy. And so that made, and the media had to report on those men. And then they began to report more on the women. And there was a snowball effect. And women have said, I am coming forward because I want people to know that it's not just one case.
Mm-hmm. And it took some time. These things take some time. I've heard some people point out that Harvey Weinstein became a target, an easy target, because his power was on the wane in Hollywood, that this is not a man at the peak of his career.
I've heard that too, and I think clearly it was silent for a long time because he was, I mean, the word I keep hearing is huge, that he was huge in the industry, and certainly he's gotten all these nominations and all these awards and made all these careers, and he himself was physically huge, so he was a forbidding figure. But, I mean, there were lots of open secrets, evidently, in the industry.
Open secrets is an interesting thing, isn't it? It assumes that people know things, or that there are rumors, more than rumors, that people know things, and including the media. The news media knows things and doesn't report them.
Well, and that's interesting, because it almost harks back to a previous period when before social media, when journalists knew all kinds of things about important people that they didn't report. I mean, supposedly, and I think this is partially true, out of good taste. I mean, every older journalist that I know was holding secrets for somebody. And then it became difficult to hold those secrets because then you would be scooped by social media. And so mm-hmm. We're kind of where we are now, where almost anything goes. But I think certainly...
Excuse me, there has to be some validity to it for it to be an open secret. There are rumors. I mean, I've been a reporter for a long time, and you hear all kinds of rumors that are never pinned down.
Reporters pretty much knew something was going on about a politician's sexual life mm-hmm. and didn't report it because it wasn't hard news.
Well, we had a case here that I wanted to share with you that doesn't involve sexual harassment, but involves prejudiced and racist comments by a member of the Baltimore City Council. So I have to go back 20, 30 years for this. But reporters all heard this particular councilman utter these racist comments, anti-Semitic comments, and he said enough colorful things that weren't anti-Semitic or racist that he was frequently quoted. He was considered a colorful character on the city council. And reporters and columnists all sort of went along with that, right? We sort of forgave his anti-Semitism and his racism. And then Roger Simon, who was a columnist here for a while, pointed this out to all of us, that after Mimi DiPietro died, that's the councilman I'm speaking of, after he died, it came out that, well, he had said some anti-Semitic and some racist things during his time in city council that were never reported. And Roger Simon was correct. Of course, Roger Simon came from Chicago, and he was here, parked here for a while, and wrote a column for a few years. So he wasn't as close to it maybe as the rest of us. And he was able to see it. And I'm thinking back that he was correct. 20 or 30 years ago, why didn't we report on what this councilman said in private, uttered to us in public, in the hallways of City Hall or out at a fundraiser or something like that? We didn't. So it's an open secret that he was a racist and an anti-Semite.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think that what he said had any relation to how he acted in terms of policy?
Yeah, it might have, when it came to African-Americans in particular. His references to Jewish people in Baltimore had to do with politics more than anything else, who was supporting which candidate, that kind of thing. But when it came to, public policy in Baltimore probably affected how he behaved and who he served in his district. Yeah.
So it might have been newsworthy.
Yep.
And I think we're discussing the nature of open secrets, that we pretend that there's this bright line between what people think in their hearts and the way they act in public, and the way they act upon other people. And if they're human, I don't see how that could be.
How that could be this bright line separating,
I think when we're talking about women in the workplace, our men, the way they flirt with somebody is really connected to the way they feel. I mean, certainly when I first came to the University of Maryland, I was in a department where I was the youngest by a whole decade, and the first woman on the faculty of the Department of Radio, TV, Motion Picture. At first, I mean, it was very clear. They didn't know what to do with me because they didn't have a category for me. And so I became this neutral person. They couldn't treat me the way they called them secretaries at the time. And I would see them catch themselves because they were about to tell an off-color, isn't that such a nice word, an off-color joke, and they realized that they couldn't. And I saw them straining and how hard it was and how uncomfortable they were. But of course, the assumption was that they had to treat me as a professional and they didn't know how. And I think there were a couple of them who actually didn't like the idea that they had to. I mean, there was actually even a moment where back then there was a film library and I walked over to get the catalog and only faculty could get the catalog. And the guy didn't give it to me. And I went back and I told the chair and he called over and the guy said, there was some girl who was trying to get the catalog, and the chair said, that was not a girl. That's our, notice, that was not a girl. That is our new assistant professor. And suddenly one got carried over to me. But the assumption was that I was a young black woman without power. Now, that's not exactly what we're talking about, but the assumption that I was a young black woman in spaces where mostly men were, and I was commonly assumed to be sexually available. I heard much later, I was only in this company for a year, it was my exercise in corporate America. Right. Somebody told me later that after my interview, after I walked out, the president said something like, it'll be really nice to look at her in the office. And then there was a moment, I was going out on a trip and we were subcontracting for another company. And the person who led the group showed up at the same site where I was, which was unusual, it was a duplication of effort. And then it became clear that he expected me to have dinner. And then it became clear that he thought I was dessert. He assumed that it had been set up that I was dessert, not just, he didn't ask, he assumed, which is a type of sexual harassment. And I went back and I reported it. And I didn't stay there very long.
Reported it?
Yeah. And there comes my attitude that this happens all the time. And when women talk among themselves, this happens all the time. And different ones of us treated differently. Mm-hmm. Many, many women, certainly women of my age, dealt with it without reporting it because the attitude was, and this is what you pick up, this is why there's an open secret, you don't mess up a man's file with that. That the woman is somewhat expendable, but you don't mess up a good man's file. I don't know how many times I've heard that said over and over again. That's where the open secret is that you don't disrupt this man's life. And in Harvey Weinstein's, you know, he has his empire. And, you know, it's real clear that some women felt they had no choice. They were coerced into doing things that they didn't want to do. And so that's where the open secret is that what's more important is the business, is the empire.
That's a good explanation for how an open secret remains an open secret, that let's protect this good man, right?
Yeah.
Who makes those assumptions? The news media?
I think.
Other people in power.
Yeah.
His peers, his board of directors, his whoever it is, right? Who might have some knowledge of it and lets it go. People allowed him to get away with it if it was an open secret, as apparently it was. That's all the news reporting I'm getting now is that everybody knew about this for a long time. But some women had made settlements with him and signed these confidentiality agreements, right? But it's coming out now. But at some point, you're right, there was a gatekeeper who decided this is personal, this could ruin his life, let's leave that alone, let's not report on it. And the rules have changed. The rules have changed about that when it comes to people in power.
Have they?
I think in the last year or so, I mean, we're seeing reporting on sexual harassment cases, multiple cases against executives and on-air personalities at Fox News.
So,
I mean, that was pretty remarkable the way all that went down.
I think we're at the tipping point. I'm not sure Roger Ailes changed America, but then you have Bill O'Reilly, and now
Bill Cosby,
right.
I mean, what did you make of the first time you started hearing these allegations against Bill Cosby, specifically, you know, slipping women a Mickey's so he could have his way with them?
Well, like a lot of people at first, I didn't want to believe it because we grew up with the Cosby Show, and you know he was this icon and he was important, but you have to believe it after a while. And I think these are extreme cases. I think there are many more cases of, you know, flirting and joking and things that are non-professional that happen every day in the workplace that women put up with because they think they have to.
What do you think it means for personal behavior in the workplace?
Well, you mean, do I think men are going to change?
I think the stories are empowering for women.
Yes.
And are warning to men.
But if you remove that behavior, there's still a period where men will have to figure out what else to do. 10 years ago, there were a couple of exposés about Wall Street, you know, the guys in the room. And that doesn't seem to have changed the culture. You know, the reports came out and women are saying they still haven't changed. So I don't want to assume that because this has become a, you know, a cultural phenomenon, that that means it doesn't blow over and things go back.
Sherry, if you hear more and more about it, like another example was Uber, right? That's another example of a workplace where apparently it was intolerable. The more you hear about it, the more that warning sounds that this isn't being tolerated anymore, guys. Right? It's a warning to men.
I hope so.
And an instruction.
I hope so. But I'm not willing to say the change has been complete.
Oh, listen, there's a lot of things people don't get. I don't understand political corruption. You know, why it keeps occurring when we have, you know, politicians being indicted all the time and going to trial and having scandals and losing their careers. So I don't understand that why things continue after there's plenty of deterrence put in front of them.
Right.
You know, examples of why you shouldn't behave this way.
Another example, though, and I'm sorry, I'm usually the optimistic person, is with the military. Remember those scandals? Well, and then, I mean, certainly the official attitude of the military has changed. They're not looking the other way. Has the behavior changed? The reports we get are not. They're still having, you know, sexual harassment cases and trying to harass women out of the military by using sexual harassment.
It's interesting that it comes at a time when Trump was elected president. There's a guy who's had all kinds of sexual harassment claims made against him, and he openly admitted that he sexually assaults women.
You know, obviously people look the other way.
He won the election a few weeks after the Access Hollywood stuff came out.
Well, he won the election. There were many people in red states who said, this is no different than the way the men we know behave. It was normalized.
I know. I read those quotes from people. Yeah. It's no different than it just got on tape.
Right.
Right? That's the only difference.
Right. I think there's much more out there than we knew. An actress said this. She said, I don't know anybody in the industry who has not been sexually harassed. I think that's true of most women. I mean, I think there's some fields where you're going to get less of it than others. But, you know, it may be people who work more out in the open. But I think almost any industry has this problem.
If you're conditioned to treat women that way, you've seen other men do it. You think that's that comes with male privilege.
Yeah.
I don't know how do you rewire those guys.
Because
unless somebody, you know, says to them, you have to stand up and say, you don't get to do this anymore.
And, you know, if someone is young enough, if you change their behavior, I mean, you do eventually change their mind. If they practice it enough, then there's lots of indication that younger men are not as bad as older men, except in some industries.
How do you teach this to young men to respect women?
Well, you teach it to boys.
You teach it to boys. How do you teach it?
Well, I think part is how they see their mothers being treated. And how they see their sisters being treated. If you treat people with respect, then they treat people with respect.
Yeah.
But if, you know, but peer culture is really important. And this happens in high schools. I mean, there's a reason why girls' schools still exist, is that it protects them from just that kind of day-to-day objectification. And
I can understand why they don't want to be around boys at that age that much, maybe a little bit, you know?
Jeez. Well, I don't want to get started on adolescent boys, but but my point is that it starts early, and that's why I think it's much harder when men are older. I do remember a case where a faculty member a long time ago at the University of Maryland had said something to a black woman that was both racist and misogynist, and he was suspended. And one of my older colleagues said, I can no longer say what comes into my head. And I said, you know, I'm a black woman. I've never been able to say exactly. I mean, I do now, actually. But then, certainly, couldn't say exactly what came into my head. And basically, he felt that he had been muted. And at the time, I said, you know, I'll take that.
What people find appealing about Trump today? That he's not muted? He says whatever comes into his head?
Right. This is the backlash of people being muted. Because their hearts haven't changed, but they can't say it in the workplace anymore.
Right. And they think you're being politically correct if you stay mum or try to respect others. Right?
Right.
They use that term. Ben Carson uses that term all the time, political correctness. when you're just being decent and civilized and living in the modern world.
Yeah, but if you really do believe that women are more stupid or that black people are more stupid, what do you do with that attitude if you can't say it? It doesn't go away.
I don't know.
It may actually, you know, back up and then...
Join the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, go to Charlottesville on the weekends? I don't...
Well, but you made a point, because clearly people who join, and we're off to hate groups, but people who join hate groups, it's more about them than it is about the other group. I mean, if they felt fulfilled as intelligent human beings, they don't have to scapegoat other groups.
So do you think we're going to have open secrets anymore? The way the society is going, the digital age, social media, changing attitudes, more women moving into places of power, we hope. I mean, what do you think?
I think that's a complex question, because
it sure is.
Because I think our concept of privacy is being eroded. I mean, I don't know about your children. My daughter's like, what is this privacy thing that you speak of? Because in the age of social media, and then the public media is much more intrusive. But I think powerful people will always be able to have secrets. There will always be elite spaces, like really expensive hotels, where one can behave in ways that you won't get away with.
At Motel 6.
Right. Yeah. Well, you might.
But I think there is something to a powerful figure being on the downside of his career, being more vulnerable to attack. Right?
I agree.
I mean, we have to agree with that.
Right.
That there's a reason why these actresses did not speak up 20 years ago.
Because it was too dangerous.
Yeah. That's still an imbalance there, right?
Right. Okay. And so that makes you ask if there's somebody on the rise that may still be doing this behavior.
Yeah. Sherry, thanks.
Thank you.
Sherry Parks is Associate Dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park, a public intellectual who joins us once a month to talk about American culture and the media. Next week on the show, Van Jones, CNN political commentator, will be my guest. We'll also hear from Heather Mazier, a former elected official in Maryland who ran unsuccessfully for governor in 2014 and is now undertaking an interesting new project that involves a podcast. And I'm looking forward to also bringing you a conversation with Julie Lithcott-Hames, who's written a fascinating and powerful book of poetic prose about race in America. Lots of good shows coming up, so please stay tuned, or, tune in when you can. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon.